What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show, everyone. Thank you so much for joining. Thank you so much for your patience. We are so excited to be here. And we have a great show for you tonight. And it's a really cool pairing, if you will. During the second half of the show, we're going to be talking to John Kiriakou. John Kiriakou is the only person to ever go to jail over the CIA torture program, which he blew the whistle on, and he is a former CIA analyst. But before we speak to John, we're going to be doing a really interesting kind of deep dive into what the hell is going on with Elon Musk, and the person guiding us through that will be Nathan Tankus. Now, before we start the show and bring on Nathan Tankus, everyone, please do give this show a thumbs up. It's a great way to express your support of the show, help the algorithm. Also, please do subscribe. Thank you so much to everyone who has subscribed. We have passed the 250,000 subs mark, which we're so happy about. We could not have done that without you, obviously. Also, if you can become Patreon supporters, please do that at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And that is a way that you can support the show. Again, we really could not do the show without your Patreon support. And if you can do the $5 a month level, we really appreciate that. And you get in return, you get access to all sorts of bonus content, extended interviews, early access interviews. So if you are a Patreon, you have access right now to the entire over 1 hour long interview with Wallace Shawn. You'll have early access to a great live show we did in Ireland, early access to an interview that we did with David Cross. And tonight, there'll be some Patreon-only content also for people who aren't watching live. If you're watching live, you're in luck. But if you're watching later and you want to see the full interview with John Kiriakou, you'll be able to do that at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. So now, I'm going to bring on our first guest. Nathan Tankus is the publisher of Notes on the Crises and research director of the Modern Money Network. He has written for the Financial Times, Politico, Rolling Stone, and more. And he's currently working on a book under contract with Viking Press of Penguin. So welcome, Nathan.
Thank you very much for having me, Katie.
Of course. And right on time, you come in. And in case we didn't know you were in New York City, you got the sirens to prove it. So welcome to your debut of the Katie Helper Show, on the Katie Helper Show. Historic moment. So you've been covering in your, what do you call it, your website? What do I call it? Your newsletter?
I say newsletter generally.
Okay, newsletter, Notes on the Crises. You've been covering various crises. So what is the crisis as you see it, or what are the interconnecting crises as you see it? If you could just break it down for us.
Yeah, so I think there is, there's the big picture globally, what is happening right now with the federal government as a whole and with Trump, the Trump administration, and Elon Musk's DOGE, so-called Department of Government Efficiency. And then there is the specific crisis that I've been focusing on in my newsletter for the past 2 weeks, and maybe I'm going to be branching out to a second one soon, which is specifically about the Treasury Department and specifically about a specific subpart of the Treasury Department called the Bureau of the Fiscal Service. So to start in the big picture is that the Trump administration and Elon Musk's DOGE are rolling through the federal government and basically firing whoever they can, getting access to all the information technology systems of various parts of the federal government with no regard to privacy laws or any other sort of restrictions of accessing very sensitive data. And so they are essentially trying to grab all the sensitive data that they can fire whoever they can, stop spending on whatever they don't want to whatever they don't want to be spent on, despite the fact that Congress has ordered the spending in what are called appropriations. And so this is a multi-layered crisis. One part of it is just stealing all of our information and using it against us for their own private purposes in terms of profit making potentially, or using it to just persecute people, and doing this under the cover of, you know, essentially an anti-woke war, anti-DEI, anti-wokeness, anti-gender ideology, which are literally, you know, in the title, like the gender one is literally, you know, gender, you know, against gender ideology and for biological truth. And also, you know, what they call the Green New Deal, which, of course, no Green New Deal has passed, but what they mean is like the Inflation Reduction Act and anything being done on climate change. And but these are culture war framings that are just justifications for gutting the parts of the federal government, or really the whole federal government, and laying off people. Like, you know, they felt that these executive orders give them the authority to, for example, fire tens of thousands of people in the agency that looks that oversees the nuclear stockpile, and then going, oh crap, we didn't realize the agency where we were firing everyone literally looks over the nuclear stockpile. Let's try to find these people and hire them, but all their government emails are deactivated, so it's actually hard to contact them. Like this level of kind of just running roughshod of through everything, and notably, you know, there's some sort of ringing in the back of your head about the Constitution or the basic, you know, what is called the separation of powers. Is Congress passes bills and the presidency, the quote unquote executive branch, is supposed to execute those laws. So the president just sort of claiming, or the executive branch just claiming the authority that they get a kind of second bite at the apple and get to decide, well, we don't care if Congress passed, you know, legislation, we get to decide spending, is a fundamental constitutional crisis. And you don't necessarily have to care about whether something's constitutional or unconstitutional. In this case, it is really bad because what this is the concentration of power in Donald Trump, apparently also Elon Musk, and away from even the courts, potentially, and maybe going much further, but also Congress, and thus the rest of us. We can say all sorts of problems with Congress, but it's a much worse situation when, you know, we kind of have this full imperial presidency where the president, and in this case, Trump, gets to sort of decide what is happening in the federal government or not. And that is tremendously, tremendously concerning. And they're trying to do this in all sorts of ways. And my specific crisis, which I've been focused on, which I was extremely alarmed about as soon as the first murmurs of it emerged, was specifically wanting access to very sensitive systems in what's called the Bureau of the Fiscal Service. And that matters because what the Bureau of the Fiscal Service does is process government payments. Like all government payments, 88% of payments in the last fiscal year run through the Bureau of the Fiscal Service. And so if you can get control, like operational control, quote unquote, of the Bureau of the Fiscal Service, you don't actually have to kind of do the hard work of taking control and installing your flunkies in every single government agency and worrying about court orders and injunctions. You can just get in there and just literally say, hey, don't process payment files from that agency,
right?
Which is what they did with USAID. And they didn't say, like, you know, love USAID or whatever, but that kind of power is extraordinarily dangerous. And they seem to be building that while still seemingly respecting the court injunctions, as far as we can tell, building an apparatus so that they can just kind of get to the point of kind of clicking buttons and, hey, I don't like anything being spent, any money being given to like this group that I don't like. And so I'm going to click a button and say no to that.
Right. It seems like there's a real misunderstanding on the part of a lot of people, I would say, where somehow, like, there's corruption in government and there's overreach committed by the government and there's power grabs committed by the government, but not by really smart dudes like Elon Musk.
Yeah.
It's like all the nefarious motives that are sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly ascribed to government are never applied to individuals or corporations. But that's obviously not true. And I wanted to jump off with an article that you did, which is pretty fascinating. This piece in your newsletter is called, I asked former Bureau of the Fiscal Service employees to interpret an Elon Musk tweet. Here's what they told me. So let's take a look at this tweet, and then we're going to discuss the larger implications of it and what it reveals to us. And let's take a look at this tweet, and sorry to put everyone through it. I'll read it out loud. Yeah. Okay. I wish I did a good, like, muted South African accent.
You know, we said this is just one tweet.
I know. So great. Okay. Do we have to call them X's now or something? Now that it's X, not Twitter.
I will never. They're tweets. Right. Yeah.
To be clear, what the Doge, and I heard you say, Nathan, in an interview, it's apparently not even Doge, it's Dougie.
That is, I've been told this multiple times, and I've decided to just extricate this in my brain. You know, if someone's going to correct me on it. Yeah. Musk calls it Doge. I've heard Musk call it in interviews Doge. He's going to call it Doge. We're just going
to
call it Doge.
Oh, wow. We're submitting to Musk. Okay. To be clear, what the Doge team and U.S. Treasury have jointly agreed makes sense is the following. Require that all outgoing government payments have a payment categorization code, which is necessary in order to pass financial audits. This is frequently left blank, making audits almost impossible. All payments must also include a rationale. Do you want me to go through this piece by piece and respond, or should I just read it all and you respond in one thing?
Let's read it all and then we'll just
go right? for it. Okay, yeah. Less painful to draw it out less. Okay. All payments must also include a rationale for the payment in the comment field, which is currently left blank. Importantly, we are not yet applying any judgment to this rationale, but simply requiring that some attempt be made to explain the payment more than nothing. The do not pay list of entities known to be fraudulent or people who are dead or are probable fronts for terrorist organizations or do not match congressional appropriations must actually be implemented and not ignored. Also, it can currently take up to a year to get on this list, which is far too long. This list should be updated at least weekly, if not daily. The above super obvious and necessary changes are being implemented by existing longtime career government employees, not anyone from Doge. It is ridiculous that these changes didn't exist already. Yesterday, I was told that there are currently over $100 billion per year of entitlements payments to individuals with no social security number or even a temporary ID number. If accurate, this is extremely suspicious. When I asked if anyone at Treasury had a rough guess for what percentage of that number is unequivocal and obvious fraud, the consensus in the room was about half, so $50 billion per year or $1 billion per week. This is utterly insane and must be addressed immediately. Okay. So what is your response to this? And what were the responses of your sources? And explain to us who your source, don't tell us who your sources were, but explain to the extent that you can who they were.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing I want to start is, like, there was a lot of detail in there. And I want to emphasize that just before you even get to the substance, the fact that he's tweeting about these topics is fundamentally insane. Like, that's fundamentally insane. Like, circa 3 weeks ago, the amount of people who knew or like with anything like knew a factoid about the Bureau of the Fiscal Service or what it did in even a one sentence description of its job was a small, small minority of people. And the amount of people who are actually like have anything approaching expertise in what these systems are first of all, like 98% of them are literally they formerly worked at the Bureau of the Fiscal Service or currently work there. Like, to give you context, like, I have talked to deputy treasury secretaries, people who've worked on like tax policy or debt management or whatever, and, you know, major parts of the government, and have gotten into some pretty minute details, and they had only the broadest conception of what the Bureau of the Fiscal Service did, because it was so technical and so outside of their purview. And so the idea that like Elon Musk is getting into tweeting about specific systems and what they do and their details about the Bureau of the Fiscal Service is fundamentally an insane concept. It's unbelievable. I mean, like, before any of this started breaking, almost no one had any idea about any of this. And like, the fact that like I knew some stuff about it and that I knew how to get quickly caught up in even more detail is like what made me like a personality that all sorts of people wanted to have me on to talk about it, or, you know, touch base with me and ask me about what I was getting into. Like, it's because this is such an obscure, minute area. And so for him to be tweeting, trying to, in his own inchoate way, intervene into like a quote unquote debate about what's going on about the system is just crazy. And so, like, I want, before we get like lost in sort of, or get into the details, which can be hard to follow, I do want to say that sort of just up front, it is just fundamentally crazy for him to be commenting about any of this at all. Like, this is normally stuff that like would be over the heads or not subject to conversation of like almost anyone in the Treasury besides literally the Treasury Secretary and the person who's running the Bureau of Fiscal Service. It's crazy. And so, you know, then, but then to get into the guts of what he's commenting, so the big context is a Doge team, and specifically a certain person, Marco Lez, 25-year-old, former employee of SpaceX, had been sent to the Bureau of the Fiscal Service to essentially, you know, commandeer it in the way that all sorts of different branches of government have been commandeered by Doge teams with very, to say the least, very unclear legal authority. And specifically, he got what was called, supposedly got what it was called, quote unquote, read-only access, which means he can look at the source code, look at the specific code of how this system operates. He can look at anyone's information that are in these systems, which is a social security number of anyone who's ever received a government payment, from a tax refund to social security, from, you know, SNAP, you know, the works. It is, you know, we're talking already about like 100-something million social security numbers, you know, sensitive bank account information, like all sorts of very personally, anything that you would want to steal someone's identity, they were letting some like 25-year-old Nazi Groiper rummage around in.
Maybe that's part of their DEI, like they need representation of, yeah, Nazi Groiper. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, diversity and equity and inclusion for Nazis. Like, yeah, that is the Doge program. And so it's already crazy for him to have that kind of what's quote unquote read-only access. But what Wired came across from sources, and then also I came across from sources.
Fell asleep, Nathan. I know you fell asleep. You beat, yeah, you by a couple of hours.
Yes, yes. I woke up at 3:30, got it out by 7:30. They beat me by 6.5 hours. Was that Marco Lez, in fact, had read-write access. And this went so rapidly that I even got to the point of being able to report on the effect of Wired and myself's reporting and his access supposedly getting revoked, and then the details of that, their sort of like, oh crap reaction. And then ultimately, after a court injunction about his involvement in these systems that Thursday morning, he resigned, supposedly over racist tweets. Again, the Trump Musk administration has diversity, equity, inclusion for Nazis. It's not very believable that he would fire racist tweets. This was reinforced even further by, you know, first Musk, then Vance, then Trump agreeing with Vance that he should be rehired. But him getting rehired back to Doge didn't necessarily mean at the Bureau of the Fiscal Service. Okay. So we had gotten, you know, the Nazi out, and now there's a big injunction based on 19 state attorney generals suing, keeping him out of the system. And so, you know, the reason that this was so concerning and why I put aside everything in my life to go write out piece after piece about piece out of that is that I was fundamentally terrified that they were going to rummage around in the system and break it. And if they break it, that means no social security checks, no social security payments, no Medicare, no Medicaid. and like the sort of just the wheels fall off on our society pretty rapidly when they just don't know how to get government payments to the entities that need payments. Because there's quite a complicated system that that connects what specific entities or people are supposed to get what payment in what bank account or to what address. And if you break that system, because we have starved government for decades and we haven't paid for, you know, IT modernization, and we've been reluctant to pay the full amounts that have been needed, our systems have been like legacy systems, but not because like government bureaucrats have been lazy about this. They've done their best kind of duct taping things and holding things together and making sure people still get their social security checks on time. But this has just been not funded. And so because it's not funded, it is a system that's very hard to change quickly. It's not a system that we've, you know, invested in building redundancies into. And so they really could do something fundamentally that breaks everything. And now that Marco Lez is out, at least for now, and they haven't sent anyone else back in, I've kind of stepped back and, you know, focused on some of the bigger picture. But the reporting has since come out, like I mentioned, the USAID thing, that they're keeping very close focus on using the Bureau of the Fiscal Service to do impoundment. And that's why I focused in on this tweet, is he is doing a bunch of justifications which sound to the uninitiated about like they are about efficiency, right, and government efficiency and auditing. But what they actually are about being able to do empowerment. So, you know, what he wants, for example, what he calls a payment categorization code, which is not a term. There's a specific technical term that the Bureau of the Fiscal Service uses called, or the Treasury uses, called a Treasury account symbol, where you can tie a specific payment to a specific kind of line item of appropriations. And the reason that he wants, like, he wants to have like this system fully nailed down is, and is like harping on it, is because he wants to just be able to like take the Treasury account symbols that he doesn't like and just kill the spending. And so one of the things that have already come out is they killed some refugee settlement money coming out of Health and Human Services based on its Treasury account symbol. And so this is just them going like, this is a type of thing that the government spends money on, and I don't like it, so I'll just kill it. And, you know, you might not care about, you know, covering the administered costs of, you know, refugee resettlement of women and children, or maybe that it's involved in some larger kind of more nefarious activities of the federal government in terms of backing ethnic cleansing, for example, in other places. But the must Trump, you know, vision of what they want to do with these codes is to just delete spending of, you know, delete any spending that has any sort of quote unquote lib coding or, you know, right, left wing or Marxist coding or whatever. And that means fundamentally trying to harm people. And this is also where this idea of a rationale comes in. You know, it might sound like it makes sense. Why shouldn't we just have a rationale on every payment? But the thing is that the rationale of these payments is that Congress appropriated the funds. Like, there was a budgetary process, there was, you know, administrative or agency process of determining the internal controls. Like, him saying you should put a rationale on every single payment going out is basically the equivalent of anytime you swipe your credit card, you should have to write a rationale to your credit card company, and then they can decide that some of that is bad spending. And so, you know, want to put it in like cultural war side the other way, if you had to put a rationale every time you swiped your credit card, then that means that the government could come in and go, well, they're swiping their credit card to buy some meat, and we think people like are consuming too much meat. So no, you can't, you know, you already bought chicken this week, so you can't buy chicken a second time or a third time or whatever it is. And fundamentally, the Bureau of the Fiscal Service is kind of just serving what I call like a payment intermediary. They're making payments on behalf of government agencies who have a budget determined by Congress. And they're just, you know, payments are supposed to go one way out the other. And they do checks for fraud and other things. There are systems for that. They have what's called the payment integrity unit. But fundamentally, like, the agencies are supposed to be the ones who check about whether you need, whether you qualify for a certain type of spending, not at the payments level. You know, one of my sources, and so this article, you know, as the title says, is based on former employees in the Bureau of the Fiscal Service. And one of them, I think, put it quite well when they said, you know, fiscal service is never going to know whether someone needs a wheelchair or not. Like, fundamentally, Health and Human Services has to check about whether you need a wheelchair, not at the payment code level. But if you're Elon Musk and you want a way to just sort of arbitrarily, capriciously hit a button and kill payments, and in fact, not only do you not find it satisfactory that there's an administrative agency process to check whether people deserve the spending or not, or you know, then it's consistent with what Congress has ordered up, that's actually a negative thing, because that's decisions that are not in your direct control. Right. Like, if the agent, it's not just that they are like, don't feel like the agency controls or checks are adequate. They're against it because that means someone else can, say, decide to continue following the law by, you know, by following a court injunction, and are not under the personal control of Elon Musk. And that is very negative. And so this is about him being able to pick and choose who deserves what spending, and, you know, making sure maybe, you know, SpaceX gets $5 billion more dollars.
While pretending just to be calling balls and strikes, right? Like, that's what, exactly. He's just a technocrat. He has no ideology. He has no skin in the game. I thought, I came across an interesting tweet, because I really do have a pet peeve when people believe people's claims about this just being about efficiency and not anything else, no ideology. So let's take a look at this tweet. So this is a tweet that was screen grabbed, and we'll look at the comment after. It was screen grabbed by Deva Hazarika. And so here's the tweet that Deva screen grabs. And it's Richard Hanania, who's what, like anti-woke right-wing kind of ghoul?
Yeah, Nazi.
Yeah. He writes, DOGE is reportedly considering cutting DEI programs, which could save an estimated $125 billion a year. This is the easiest no-brainer of anything in the federal government. I'd be surprised if they didn't do it. And then Elon Musk tweets, no-brainer. And then you take a look at what this really is. And let me just read the actual tweet. So here, is that visible? Yeah. The DOGE stuff is so unserious. The no-brainer $125 billion savings includes $120 billion that are simply a goal of how much of its spending the government wants to contract to, quote, socially, economically disadvantaged, unquote, small business. Sure, get rid of that if you want, but it saves $0. Yeah. So just like one example of how this is nonsense dressed up as intelligence. Or not even nonsense. It's more nefarious than nonsense. There's an agenda.
Yeah, there's an agenda, but also there is also just a stupidity to this, because like Musk isn't a particularly smart person, to say the least, and he certainly has no expertise in how government works. And sure, there are, you know, things that we can talk about as leftists that we have problems in various specific areas, you know, that you could go after. You know, for example, notably, there's the Department of Defense, which they have basically left alone so far, right, and has the manifold actual accounting problems that aren't happening or happening to a much lesser degree with other agencies, which they're not touching. But fundamentally, Musk just knows so little that he doesn't even know the basics of what to get rid of or not. I mean, like this recent thing where they're firing all probationary employees, and they think that that means they're firing all new employees, but it also means they're firing anyone who's been recently promoted to a job, to a higher position, and could return to a lower position if they don't succeed at that. Like, it's because they literally just like control F for probationary and don't realize what they're doing, and that they're actually firing a lot of high level important people who are like, say, keeping the planes in the air or something.
Right.
they just fundamentally know so little about this that it's a mixture of an aggressive agenda that, you know, aggressive agenda that is unconstitutionally centralizing power in Musk and Trump's hand, but also doing a whole set of extremely stupid things that are so stupid that they're dangerous. And it is like there's a quite actually like difficult race between how much of the damage is their agenda and how much of the damage is their stupidity. And one starts edging out the other at any given time. And then the other like makes a come from behind, you know, acceleration to get back in the lead.
At least it's exciting.
Sure is.
Today, Nathan, you announced the start of a deeper investigation into Doge's attempts at accessing taxpayer information at the IRS. So can you explain to us more about this and its possible implications? And I know you're only at the beginning, but yeah.
Yeah, this is the early stages. I didn't write about this in the piece, but we know the guy who they're going after, or the guy who is the Musk person being sent to this. I'm blanking on the name offhand because I don't have it in front of me and I hadn't included it in the piece. But among other things, this person, according to like a now deleted Substack, a paid Substack, premium Substack post, they were radicalized by an article in the UNS Review, which among other things is a publication put out by this guy who's a far right Holocaust denier type. So, and this kid's manifesto, who's going to be rolling around in IRS data, or seems to be as of this moment going to be rolling around in IRS data, is of a piece with that. And I've had it in my mind, in the back of my mind, that they were also going to get an IRS. As I say in my piece, there was this little tidbit that had stuck in my head in the first reporting that got me on to what I've been calling the Treasury payments crisis, where they said that they had the same inquiries for quote unquote source code information or wanting, you know, direct access to the systems that they wanted for the Bureau of the Fiscal Service, they had also been wanting for the IRS. And so I was so overwhelmed with the payment stuff that I was just like, I hope that doesn't happen anytime soon and I can like wait to focus on it. But it's ever since then, I've been expecting for them to come from the IRS. And a couple days ago, Jeff Stein and Jacob Bagaj broke the story in the Washington Post that yes, indeed, they're going after the IRS systems. There seems to be a draft memorandum of understanding giving this kid, you know, free rein to one very important system. And it has a lot of the same shape of what happened at the Bureau of the Fiscal Service. There's also a similar thing going on at Social Security, and actually the head of the Social Security Commissioner, who was Trump's acting commissioner that he selected when he came in, similar to the Bureau of the Fiscal Service, has resigned in protest for the accessing of sensitive data. And the same thing is now happening at the IRS. So I put out like a little kind of just six paragraph description of the situation. But for the purpose of trying to get former and current IRS employees sources and get a greater understanding. You know, some of these things are similar. Like I know a lot about mission critical, or it's called mission critical because they're very important and can't ever go down for even a small period of time. Legacy IT systems and this computer programming language known as COBOL. So I have some of the overlapping expertise to understand it, but I know much less about the details of the tax system as I do about payments. Taxes, you know, seem like from what I've just already gleaned, are much more complicated systems than the payment systems, which are already complicated because, you know, there's this phrase in coding called business logic. And what is the idea is that there's a programming language, but then there is business logic, meaning specific kind of logical statements you use with the code that direct a specific thing to happen. So, for example, like this type of payment you know, which is a Social Security payment, and this goes to this type of recipient, and these are for households or whatever it is, that kind of logic is not something inherent to just the programming language in general. It's a kind of logic that you build in with code, and it's already pretty complicated with payments, but imagine the size and complexity of the tax code, and that you have to have systems that are able to like connect all these different thing elements and do checks and make sure that people are having their taxes calculated correctly, or checking what they themselves, you know, what you're filing, and make sure that they're accurate. That, and there's all sorts of different types of taxes, and you know, the tax, I mean, it's not a news thing that the tax code is extremely, extremely complicated, but when you're thinking about it as like code system, IT systems that are even less modernized than the Bureau of the Fiscal Service, we're talking about quite complicated systems, some systems that still literally kind of have some of the same code, even if like somewhat modernized or are on new machines, literally from like 1959, because again, the IRS has been starved of budget and hasn't been able to do IT modernization. These systems are very, very, very complicated, and it's hard for me to get a sense of how much of the complexity is lack of modernization, how much of the complexity is just the tax code's way more complicated. And so this is something I'm still at the early stages of.
Right.
Getting my hands on.
And Nathan, you, your reporting on this has earned you a lot of media coverage, and it's even earned you praise from people like Robert Reich. And I'm not going to hold this against you, but from Paul Krugman. It's okay. This is a safe space. But I bring up Paul Krugman because it's important, I think, to note that you are not a lib or resistance lib. You obviously are critical of Trump, but you're not uncritical, to say the least, of the Democrats. So I want to ask you, how did the Democrats enable or facilitate Trump kind of generally, but also what we're now seeing with Trump and Musk and Doge?
Yeah, so I think there's two elements. And of course, the topic of how the Democrats enabled the current kind of fascist takeover, there's manifold. But in terms of my area of expertise or what I'm focusing on now, I think there's two crucial elements. One is, and Musk has even started tweeting about this in his own way, of why is everyone getting all, you know, all up in a tizzy about the Department of Government Efficiency? We're just doing what Clinton did in the 90s with reinventing government. And they cut the government workforce by a lot. And this is both kind of a savvy rhetorical move, also kind of an obstinate one because, you know, they passed legislation to do that. But fundamentally, the kind of, well, they passed legislation to do that isn't a good response, because what that says is, oh, this isn't a fundamental problem. This is just a technical detail. And they, I don't know, haven't filled out the right paperwork. And if they're doing the right thing anyway, then why do we care if they're doing it this way or not? Now, there's answers I could come up with that, you know, on that about centralization of power and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's not a very good answer. The fundamental answer is that was bad then, too. Like, they pretended like they were saving the U.S. society money, or, you know, making our society more efficient. What we just did had was a less capable government. Like, we government and government employment has nowhere near kept up with the size and the complexity and of government and of the economy and all the sort of manifold things that are going on in our society. And a less capable government is less capable of doing various different things, including keeping corporate interests accountable. Like, why are they interested in gutting the IRS? Yeah, well, one of the positive things I will say that the Biden administration did, but this is kind of like was a little like too little too late, was increasing funding to the IRS. And why were they increasing funding to the IRS? So they could go after rich tax cheats. Because if you have no money, then if you have no budget, then the tax sheets you go after are just penny-ante poor people tax sheets, or ordinary people, or, right, you know, a small micro business, you know, sole proprietor. You need a big budget if you're going to go after the biggest corporations or society or billionaires for cheating taxes. Well, if you're Elon Musk, if you're the richest man in the world and connected up with all these other ghouls, well, you want to fire 5,000 people from the IRS so they can never go after rich tax cheats ever again. Like, that's a positive thing in government that they don't want to exist. And that's what they're gutting. But, you know, it's not like the Clinton administration or Democrats during the Bush era were like pushing hard at like increased funding for the IRS to go after rich tax cheats. They were all going in the other direction, you know, government starvation to make government more inefficient and more and less capable. But if you're the Democratic leadership now, who are all the same people because they're all like just still there and they're 80 or something, you know, Chuck Schumer and the rest, then you have no real like effective like thing that you can really say that can like put all of this together, that can connect the corporate issues and right. and the centralization of power and give a real narrative to push forward. The second thing that I think is important is all the apparatuses that the federal government has can now be easily accessed by the Trump administration and Elon Musk to go after their enemies. And these are all apparatuses that not only did the Democratic Party not resist, but they actively encouraged themselves. Well, things that are called, say, anti-money laundering or know your customer laws or countering the financing of terror laws. These are systems where we deputize the banking system, money transmitters, so on, to go after people, to surveil their customers on behalf of government and do all sorts of capricious things, arbitrarily closing people's bank accounts and so on without any due process, and creating lists, you know, like what's called, you know, the OFAC list, which is the, you know, it's basically an office for foreign assets control. Yeah, office of foreign assets control. And but that's not just foreigners. And oh, you can put Americans on this list without any due process. And now you're on that list. And now you are financially blacklisted and or you can't be, say, a legitimate nonprofit. And so, you know, this is something I was tweeting about in October about Samadoun, one of these important Palestinian nonprofits supporting Palestinian prisoners, you know, political prisoners, essentially, who are just arbitrarily detained or, you know, convicted in kangaroo Israeli courts. This was something that the Biden administration was doing, you know, in October, you know, right as we were gearing up for the election that ultimately Trump won, and all of this sort of surveillance apparatus, the ability to blacklist people, is there. And that's, you know, one of the really concerning things about that Elon Musk tweet. It's so long, it's got so many things in it, is him talking about how the quote unquote do not pay list is not updated quickly enough. And no one I talked to could figure out what he was talking about because it doesn't make any sense, you know. But one of the things that goes through do not pay is the OFAC list. And so when I read that tweet, what I think he is talking about being able to add any enemy he wants, any person he wants, any entity to the OFAC list, and to just financially disappear them, essentially, because and they can never receive a government payment. But the OFAC list is also a list that goes through the entire banking system. So it means just like if Musk doesn't like someone, you can be blacklisted from the banking system. And as we're seeing, there's no checks or controls on any of that except kind of inchoate public outrage. And the Democratic Party willingly handed over this system, built the system so that it could be taken over, and notably did nothing during the lame duck period from Trump being president-elect to being president to stop this. You know, I happened to be in a room in November with a bunch that, among other things, had a bunch of Democratic Party operatives. And I was like, if you guys really believed that Trump was a fascist, you would destroy all the surveillance, you know, compute data. That's something you would do. And of course, they're Democrats. They never do that in a million billion years. But they've handed over a full system that can be used against anyone because it was useful for them. It was useful to go after Palestinian activists and left-wing activists and all sorts of other people and, you know, genuine national security threats, quote unquote, whatever you want to say, with very little due process. And now we'll see where this goes.
Right. Well, you know, that I actually want to ask you about this because, Nathan, you've been a very outspoken presence when it comes to the weaponization of the Holocaust to justify genocide. Could you share a little bit about your own family's history and how you see what is happening now with the legacy of the Holocaust?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, there's a lot to say there. And I have a lot of different, a lot of half-written things that I've been waiting to put out there, but I just haven't quite found the words in print.
Well, we can actually show, we have some really great tweets of yours if you want to use those as a jumping off point. So
this is one,
and if you could read this and then we can use this as a prompt. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is related to the Samadoun point, and I was tweeting it or related to that day. So I have a very simple principle. I'm against any law, implementation of a law or interpretation of a law, which, if applied in a logically consistent way, would have harmed Jewish resistance in Nazi Germany, in occupied Poland, or justified the murder of Jews during the Nazi Holocaust.
Okay. And then you have another one. Let's take a look at the other one because I think they go well.
They
dovetail.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, this is what I tweeted October 8th.
2023, the day after. Wow.
Let me be crystal clear. As a Jewish grandchild of Holocaust survivors, I'm always on the side of the people imprisoned in ghettos and not on the incredibly armed and modern arm, not with the incredibly armed and modern army who served as their jailers. You're not going to be able to bully me into another opinion. I don't want anyone to die, but I also won't participate in contextless haranguing of military strategy launched from a ghetto, whether it's Jewish partisans during World War II or, yes, even Hamas. Whether or not I, a Jewish writer living in New York, criticize Hamas is irrelevant. And then, I kind of go on from there about, the question is just about whether you support cutting off military aid or not. Obviously, you can imagine tweeting something like that, especially with the kind of traditional following that I have, largely around finance or economic policy. That was an interesting couple of weeks after, having tweeted that October 8th. And then obviously continuing to tweet about what was going on.
What is your family? People, I think, don't realize that there's a whole legacy. And you and I, full disclosure, have a shared institution, Camp Kinderland, from which we both graduated. Yes. But your family was not, like, historically was not a Zionist family. A lot of people don't know that there's a whole Jewish tradition, culture, and heritage and history that was either not Zionist or anti-Zionist. So I wanted to know if you could share a little bit of that.
I come from, the background that speaks to me the most is, my father's mother, my bubby, her father were Bundists, the Jewish Labor Bund. My bubby was born in Vilna, now Vilnius, which was kind of the center of Jewish life in interwar Europe, known as kind of the Jerusalem of Eastern Europe or the Jerusalem of Lithuania, however you want to put it. And, grew up with fundamental, like, Bundist commitments, which meant, fighting where you were, fighting for socialism, a revolutionary socialism, but not necessarily a Bolshevik socialism, and fighting for, cultural freedom, the ability to pursue the culture that you want, to kind of have a Jewish education, a Yiddish education. My great-grandfather, it's a longer story of all the things that my great-grandfather was involved in, but among other things, he was a principal in the network of schools that was backed by the Jewish Labor Bunds, Chayo schools. He was head of the network of Vilna schools from 1930 to 1934 until kind of capricious government Polish authorities kind of forced two schools together, and he became the principal of this much larger school in Vilna. And then in spring 1939, he ran and won under a Bund ticket for the city council in Vilna. and his best friend from teacher seminary was this guy named Levick Otis. I'll have more to say about him in writing and in other places, but was very well known at the time, kind of left-wing Bundist who has a lot of very prescient writing about Zionism after the Holocaust in, 1946, 1947. And so, I come from that tradition. Time moves on and political institutions decay. So there are some circles in which there's a like kind of a cultural love for the Bund. You know, I love Yiddish. I love the culture. I love this. I love that. But the politics, and especially certain elements of the politics, like anti-Zionism, hasn't held up as much. But for me, it was something that I connected with from my teenage years, and became some of my first adult political opinions. And let's just say the last 15 years have been quite a time period to be constantly reinforced in those political commitments and find them more deeper and more fundamental rather than lose them, which say some people in earlier generations did.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I guess the last thing I wanted to ask you was if you had any advice on how we fight what is happening now, fight against it. Yeah. Range from the Elon Musk, the Doge stuff to the, attack on the welfare state to Gaza. Really easy way to end the interview, right?
Yeah, I think it's a tricky thing that is going to involve a lot of thinking because, the people first and foremost who are focusing on these issues are resistance liberals. And there is good reason for why leftists are very skeptical, to say the least, to what resistance liberals are taking as important. I would say in this case, forthrightly, I think this stuff is really important. And I don't think that it should be left to resistance liberals. I think there is opening here. There's a unique opening here where there's a lot of very disenchanted resistance liberals who are finally kind of maybe momentarily disenchanted with what the Democratic Party is offering up, because they're looking for a fight. They're looking for people who are going to confront Trump and Musk and are not seeing it. There are some of these people who normally you'd be eye rolling about how pro Democrat they are the kind of people who at rallies are yelling at Chuck Schumer. And so I think that there's an opening and opportunity to enter these spaces, to go into sort of physical protests in person at government buildings, obviously, especially in DC, but there's other kind of strategies you can pursue. And at the same time, the Democratic Party has contributed building systems that now Trump and Musk are using. So it's, getting people to take privacy seriously, flipping them from their like pro-national security, like I'm going to look to the FBI to fix things, to look, they're taking over these apparatuses pretty easily and there's no checks and balances. So that means there wasn't ever really any checks and balances. So you should, except for norms, and you should have a problem with that. And I would say, I think I've generally speaking have positive response from people who are following me kind of more from the resistance liberal angle. Two things I have to say about, OFAC or anti-money laundering, know your customer laws. Like they're more open than they've ever been before to these criticisms. And so I think, but it's difficult. It is really difficult. There's a big tension there. And there's a lot of people who certainly are not going to be that willing to listen to you on Palestine or Gaza who are mobilized on this. So I think it's a tricky question that I don't really have anywhere near a full answer to. I would just say, I think this stuff is very important. I don't think we can say larger complex things about what Trump's election has meant for Palestine in general, but I don't think the specific taking over these agencies and their more and more capricious use is going to be good for anyone. And so I think it is worth challenging. It's just tough it's tough with what we were left with from, Biden and more than a year of Democratic Party backing genocide and so on. So it's tough. There's really is no good answer. We kind of just have to try stuff and figure it out. Yeah.
You can work with people that you wouldn't want to have over for dinner.
That's definitely true.
Yeah. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for joining.
Yeah.
And we'll link your work in the description.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nathan.
Bye.
Bye. All right, everyone. That was a great discussion. And we are moving right along to our next guest. John Kiriakou is the only person to go to jail over the CIA torture program, which he blew the whistle on. He is a former CIA analyst and case officer, a Penn USA Award winner and bestselling author. He's the host of Political Misfits and writes at johnkiriakou.substack.com. So welcome, John.
Hey, thank you. Good to be back.
Of course. Thanks for coming. So much to talk about with you. Let's see where to start. Why don't we start with your thoughts on what Elon Musk is doing? And I guess wanted to know specifically about the connection between the deep state and the broligarchy. And in fact, we could maybe start with a clip. There's a clip of Alex Karp from Palantir. Is that how you say Palantir?
Palantir.
Mm-hmm. Palantir. Yeah, Palantir. Not to be confused with Palante, which is the slogan of the young lords, which is why I always struggle with it. And here he is talking about Elon Musk. Let's take a listen, and then I'd love to have your reaction.
What I don't like about what's going on is I just view this as, well, let's watch the Democratic Party commit suicide. And like, I've been a Democrat most of my life. I kind of view myself as outside it, but I don't like watching the Democrats just commit suicide. And what I see is most of the country doesn't really, at this point, given the fraud, waste, and abuse we know is there, 90% of the country is like, get rid of that fraud, waste, and abuse. And I just view this as yet another example of the progressive left boxing themselves in into a suicide dance. Now, what the progressive left should be doing is saying, okay, Elon, you're clearly the most qualified person in the world to do something like this. We want a dialogue with you about how you're doing and what are you doing. I don't believe that's actually what happened. And again, I like Elon. I know I think he's obviously the most important builder in the world. And I just think, if you want to say my former side, I don't believe that they're actually engaging. I think it's like another dance where I'm supposed to say, of course, like whatever. It's like there's this one issue where I might, and then you get boxed into you cannot solve the problem. And then I would say, what is the biggest problem in this society? Biggest problem in this society, from my perspective, is legitimacy of our institutions. Why aren't they legitimate? They're not legitimate because, okay, do any of you really believe that 99% of your taxpayer dollars are being spent? But last and not least, and probably arguably most importantly, there's two revolutions happening. One is transparency and one is AI. Okay, so why is it that we do not know where every penny of our money goes? Like, how do you explain that to people? And by the way, slightly more technically, what large language models do is they mean you can go into the contracts and see exactly what happened. So in the past, we couldn't do this. Now we can. The right response is, we want this to happen. We want to happen. We want to be involved in the dialogue. The real response is, it feels like the people criticizing Elon don't want it to happen. And this is going to destroy those people.
Okay, a lot to unpack there.
Wow.
A lot of incoherence too.
Incoherence. My first thought is, if he dyed his hair dark brown, he could pass for Rachel Maddow, because it sounded like I was listening to Rachel Maddow make apologies for the Democratic National Committee. That's what that sounded like.
Yeah. Someone should do a mashup.
This has nothing to do with the progressive left. You and I are on the progressive left, and we're not Democrats.
Right.
You know, Democrats who consider themselves to be on the progressive left are not progressive or left. You know, when the DNC celebrates the fact that the Democratic candidate for president had just received the endorsement of Dick Cheney, that's not a brag. And that's not progressive, right. And it's not leftist. You know, there's an issue here too, Katie, where we trick ourselves into thinking that we get to choose one of two choices. Either you choose Elon Musk and Donald Trump tearing the whole place down, or you choose the status quo. Well, that's not the case. There's a third choice, and the third choice is to fix it. Right? Republicans and Democrats alike have conveniently forgotten that year after year after year, they appropriate more money than the Pentagon has even asked for. they make excuses year after year after year for the fact that there has never been a successful audit of the Defense Department budget. So fix it. You know, when he says that there's no transparency to the point where we can't see what the federal budget is. Of course we can. It's all online. It's long and it's complicated. And you can't really see what the intelligence community budget is because it's all, you know, hidden here and there and everywhere. William Pluxmeyer could have told us all about that. But people just don't go to the trouble. So there is a third way. It's to fix it, not to either, you know, burn it down like a California wildfire or just to pretend that there is no problem in government. Did you know, my sister just texted me that the Kennedy Library abruptly shut down today at 2:00 because of a presidential executive order. Donald Trump fired everybody. And so they just can't remain open. It's a presidential library, for heaven's sake. How does that save us money? How does laying off everybody at FEMA save us money? Just wait until the next flood or tornado or hurricane or wildfire, and then we're screwed. So I'm just not getting it.
Yeah, and there's also all this hypocrisy. I mean, so Adam Johnson, who tweeted out that clip of Karp, tweets, Palantir was seeded by the CIA's investment arm in Qtel in 2003. It's received $2.5 billion in federal contracts. These guys are total sponges on taxpayer dollars, yet play the part of rebel outsiders because they want to remove oversight and mop up all the government contracts for themselves. Yeah, which is, I think, something we see frequently. It's this idea, people who claim to be anti-government, they just want the government funding them, not programs that they don't like.
Exactly. In the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, the CIA got congressional approval to create a venture capital fund. Unprecedented. Because no governmental entity is supposed to have the kind of power that creation and exploitation of a venture capital fund would entail. But Congress gave it to them. And the first thing they did was to set up this fund, which is quasi-governmental. It's called INQTEL, INQTEL. It's the word intel, with the slang for intelligence, with a letter Q in the middle as kind of a wink, wink nod to Q from the James Bond movies. Very cute. And so it went out there and it started investing in companies that could invent really cool, really complicated things that the CIA was interested in. And one of the things that it invested in was Palantir. Palantir was a failing tech company until the CIA put money in it. And then all of a sudden it succeeded. And it succeeded because as soon as that money was invested, Palantir essentially began working for the CIA. This was in 2003. By 2013, Palantir was the biggest provider of classified software in the entire intelligence community, and not just the intelligence community, but the Pentagon as well. It was in 2013 that Palantir finally developed software that allowed the CIA and FBI computer systems to be interconnected. Can you imagine? It took 12 years after the 9/11 attacks so that the CIA and the FBI could exchange classified messages. Ridiculous. And now everybody got rich. They got rich with taxpayer money.
Right. Wow. Well, you know, John, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is your own case, because people know that you're a whistleblower, but people may not know that there's been a kind of bipartisan refusal to pardon you for whistleblowing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's disgusting. You blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program. Mm-hmm. And then you're punishment for that, your prize for being honest and exposing something like that, is being thrown into jail, thrown into prison, losing your pension.
Yeah, that's the big part.
Yeah. And I mean, boy, I assume as someone who hasn't been subjected to either of those horrors, I assume they must both be extremely traumatic and traumatizing. And the idea that the only person to pay a price is the person not who engaged in the torture, but blew the whistle on it. Can you shed a little bit of light onto how that happened? Then I want to ask you about the pardon process, because you actually wrote an article on the defunct pardon process, in which you call for a change and you explain what needs to happen. So can you unpack all of that I threw a lot at you. Sorry.
No, that's okay. So I gave a nationally televised interview to ABC News in December of 2007, in which I said that the CIA was torturing its prisoners, that torture was official US government policy, and that the policy had been personally approved by the president. This is when it goes into the Twilight Zone. The very next day, the CIA filed what's called a crimes report against me with the FBI, saying that I had revealed classified information, top secret information in this interview. The FBI investigated me for a year, from December of 07 to December of 08. And they finally sent my attorneys what's called a declination letter, declining to prosecute me. They said that it was illegal to classify a criminal act. Torture was a criminal act, and so I had not committed a crime by revealing it. Great. I'm home free. 3 weeks later, Barack Obama becomes president, and he names John Brennan as the Deputy National Security Advisor for Counterterrorism. John and I always hated each other. And one of the dirty little secrets was that John Brennan was one of the fathers of the CIA's torture program. He pretended to be, you know, a progressive Democrat. He never was. He was a pro-torture independent. So I had no idea that as soon as he was given this position of Deputy National Security Advisor, he asked the Justice Department to secretly reopen the case against me. In discovery later on, we found three memos. There was a memo from Brennan to Eric Holder, the Attorney General, saying, charge him with espionage. And Holder wrote back and said, my people don't think he committed espionage. And then Brennan wrote back and said, charge him anyway and make him defend himself. And so they charged me with three counts of espionage. Mind you, espionage can carry the death penalty. And then when I went bankrupt, they dropped the charges. So I ended up taking a plea to a lesser charge. But I was looking at my phone a minute ago so I could pull this up. I received this email anonymously a month ago, and it says, dear John, it's nice to finally write to you. I've been watching your YouTube videos and I love all the content, and I've been wanting to reach out to you for many years. I'm one of the FBI agents who wants to personally apologize to you for the disgraceful way that the FBI and our government treated you. I worked with both headquarters and the Washington field office team on your case, and I know many of the personnel that you're familiar with. That case was directed and driven by senior-most officials. Many mid-level and street personnel were against it, but nevertheless, we just followed orders. Anyway, I've always felt bad about what we did to you and for you and for the way you were treated, and I wanted to personally apologize. Sincerely, Joe. That's the third one of those I've gotten. The third one. So, you know, when you embarrass the CIA and you air the dirty laundry, there's going to be a very heavy price to pay. It cost me literally everything. My marriage, my career, my freedom, my children. It cost everything, which is the plan.
Right.
One of my attorneys said to me, well, in the midst of all this, they said, you know, this case isn't just about John Kiriakou. This case is about frightening anybody else in the intelligence community who might be thinking about coming forward to report on criminal activity inside the organization. And that's true. You know, Ed Snowden said that Tom Drake and I inspired him to go public with his revelations. And that meant the world to me. And knowing that there are other whistleblowers out there who, you know, if they don't go to the media, they go to the oversight committees, they go to an attorney or whatever. That makes it all worthwhile. Now, the pardon process. I applied for a pardon with Barack Obama. I was ignored. I knew I would be. Then I applied for a pardon from Donald Trump in Trump's first term. And I was close. And it made the papers a couple times. Once because Rudy Giuliani tried to shake me down for $2 million. And I ratted him out to the New York Times and it made the front page.
I don't think I know this story.
Oh, this was a big one. So I have a friend who is close to Giuliani. And people kept saying, oh, you're close, but if Giuliani gives you the thumbs up, Trump's going to give it to you. I said, okay, how do I get to Giuliani? Well, I know this guy and he works for Giuliani. So I called him and he said, okay, let's meet up at the Trump Hotel. You and your lawyer, Giuliani and me. I said, great. So we go to the Trump Hotel. Giuliani's there. And we're sitting there. And Giuliani says, so, you know, the Mets are looking good this year. And I'm like, yeah, great. Are you a football fan? I said, yeah, I'm a Steelers fan. I understand you're a Giants fan. Yeah, I love the Giants. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Finally, I said, so, Mr. Mayor, I appreciate you taking the time to see me, but I wanted to talk about this pardon. And he says like this, anybody know where the pisser is? And he gets up and he walks away. I said to the guy, what just happened? And he said, you never talked to Rudy about a pardon. You talked to me about a pardon and I talked to Rudy. I'm like, okay, whatever. Like these guys watch too many episodes of The Sopranos. So he says, Rudy's going to want 2 million. And I laughed. And I said, look, I don't have 2 million. I'll never have 2 million. But why would I spend $2 million to recover a $700,000 pension? That doesn't make any sense. I said, look, I don't want to waste your time. I appreciate you seeing me. And I got up, my lawyer, and we walked away. So that night, a friend of mine had a book launch party. And I went to the party. And there was another whistleblower there that I'm friendly with. And he said to me innocently, he said, so how was your day? I said, oh, how was my day? Listen to this. I said, Rudy Giuliani tried to shake me down for 2 million bucks. And I told him, and he said, did you call the FBI? And I said, I don't talk to those rats at the FBI. I'm not a snitch, right? I didn't call the FBI. A couple of days later, I happened to be standing in my attorney's office. We were chatting and my phone rang and it was Mike Schmidt from the New York Times. And he said that a little birdie had told him that Rudy Giuliani tried to shake me down for $2 million. Was that true? So I said, hold on a second. I said to my lawyer, should I talk to the New York Times? He said, yeah, tell him the truth. So I said, yeah, I'll talk to you. He said, will you go on the record? I said, sure, use my name. I told him the whole story. And he said, actually, you're the fourth person that he approached and tried to take $2 million from for a pardon. And it's because he was getting a divorce. He was a member of 16 country clubs. He spent $10,000 a month on cigars. And he needed this money to continue, you know, the lifestyle to which he had grown accustomed. So
no wonder he has that terrible hair dye. He couldn't afford a good hairdresser and it dripped down his face.
Yeah. Exactly. He does, you know, Just for Men or whatever the spray is. So so he denied and denied and denied. He said that he had never met me, that he hadn't been in Washington that day. So I sent the New York Times a picture of the four of us together that we took in the lobby. And they wrote, the New York Times has seen documentary evidence that the meeting took place. Well, when Noelle, I forget her last name, his assistant, went public about her sexual harassment case, she said that he told her the day of the New York Times article that that son of a bitch CIA guy ratted me out to the Times. And I said, yep, I did. So a long way of saying Giuliani didn't help me, but I got that close because Tucker Carlson helped me. I had been on Tucker's show a dozen times. He loves when I criticize the agency. We became friends and he went to Trump for me and he said, he's going to do it. Then on the last day of the Trump presidency, Tucker called me and said that Mitch McConnell had called him and killed it. Because Mitch McConnell said that if Trump pardoned, and this was the original idea, Trump was going to pardon Julian Assange, Ed Snowden, and me. And McConnell didn't know me, but he said if Trump pardoned Assange and Snowden, that he couldn't control the Republican caucus in the Senate and that they would probably vote to convict him on the impeachment charges. So he dropped our pardons. Then I go to Biden and I'm friendly with a Greek Orthodox priest who's very, very close to Joe Biden. He said, I can help you. So I'm getting, you know, this guy to write a letter and that guy to write a letter and Senator so-and-so and Congressman, what's his name? And I got Annette Bening and I got Susan Sarandon and Mike Farrell, and I got a whole Hollywood contingent. And then he passed me over. And I said to the priest, because the priest was like, nobody's as close to him as I am. I'm Hunter's godfather, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, if I had been a crackhead or a Chinese spy or a judge that sold children into bondage, maybe I would have gotten. So fuck Joe Biden. Excuse my language.
And one of those kids killed himself, by the way. One of the kids from the Cash for Kids.
You are exactly correct. He killed himself. He was like 16 years old.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying with Trump again. And without even trying, Alan Dershowitz called me and said, hey, are you going to apply for a pardon? I said, yeah, I'd like to. I said, I'm kind of disillusioned now. And he said, no, he said, I'll write a letter and then we can circulate it and maybe get some other people to sign. So I got Alan Dershowitz, I got Tucker Carlson, I got Judge Napolitano and two high ranking friends of Trump that nobody's ever heard of in this venue. And so we're going to go again and I'm going to try my best. We'll see what happens. But, you know, I like to think that I'm going to get a fair shake from the Republicans on this because it was Barack Obama and John Brennan and Eric Holder that put me in prison and covered up war crimes and crimes against humanity. It was not Donald Trump. There are a lot of things we can criticize Donald Trump over.
Sure.
But this is not one of them.
Why did Obama pardon Manning and not the rest of you guys?
He didn't. He gave Manning a commutation.
Okay, right.
So Manning's still a convicted felon.
Right. He gave clemency and commutation. Yeah, is that it?
Clemency. Okay. You know, and I'll tell you another story that answers that question. I have very, very strong support in the Greek American community for a pardon, and I mean like the Archbishop, the Bishop of Pittsburgh, these two Greek American billionaires, the former Lieutenant Governor of New York, Alexei Genoulias, the Secretary of State of Illinois, great, great support. And these two billionaires, one of them called me and I went up to New York to meet with the two of them. And they said, look, we know Joe Biden very well. And we can get to him directly. Do you want to meet with him? And I said, yes. So I said, listen, I have a letter signed by 70 former CIA officers asking that I be pardoned. I have a letter written by the man who wrote the law that I was convicted of violating, saying I should never have been charged in the first place. I have a floor statement from John McCain saying I should be pardoned, from a liberal Democratic congressman saying I should be pardoned. But maybe most importantly, I have an op-ed from the Christian Science Monitor from Senator Joe Biden saying that the law that I was convicted of violating was unconstitutional and should never have been passed. So we go to Wilmington to meet with Biden. This is like 4 or 5 days before Trump became president. So we go to Biden, I make my pitch, and we all get on the train. Not Biden, the two Greeks and I got on the train. We came to Washington. I went home. They went to the White House for a dinner that they were invited to. I waited up late into the night. Finally, at midnight, they called me and they said, you would have been so proud of Joe Biden tonight. He went to the mat for you. But halfway through his pitch, Obama put up his hands and said, guys, I'm just not going to do this. It's either him or it's Manning. And Manning got 30 years. And I said, why are we mutually exclusive?
Right.
What does it cost Barack Obama to do the right thing? But he didn't do it. And then honestly, by the time Biden was able to do it, he was so demented that, I mean, I don't have any idea who made that decision.
Right.
I don't think it was Biden. Wow. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah, it sucks.
At least you know that a lot of people support you and, you know, believe in you and support your work and tune into you. And
great pride in that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Great pride.
And
you know what? If I can interrupt you for 1 second.
Yeah, of course.
I would do the whole doggone thing over again.
Really?
I would. I mean, my wife and I split up. I lost my pension. I lost my security clearance. I lost my job. And I don't care because it was the right thing to do. And torture is outlawed in this country now. And I'm proud to have played a role in that. You know, you come to some issues where you know that you're right and they're wrong. And eventually everybody else is going to see that. So I don't care. You know, and this is one of the things when you apply for a pardon, when you make a formal application, we could talk about the process whenever you want. You have to show proof that you showed contrition. And I'm not contrite.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, right. Are you sorry for the crime you committed? And I said, no, I'm not. No, I would do it again.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. Did you ever have regrets? Were you ever like, God, why did I do the principal thing? It would have been so much easier not to.
Oh, yeah. When
like moments of it, yeah.
Yeah, when the Justice Department offered me 45 years in prison and told me that was the best deal I was going to get, I intended to commit suicide that night. And my wife and I were up watching TV and she said, let's go to bed. And I said, no, I'm going to stay up late. I'm going to just watch TV. I wasn't going to watch TV. I was going to go down to the garage and just, you know, put a pipe in my mouth. And I think she sensed it. And she said, no, we should go to bed. And she kind of talked me out of it. So,
wow.
Yeah. So yeah, there were times when I thought, oh my God, what have I done? What have I done? And then, yeah, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, no, somebody had to do it. We're led by a cabal of criminals and somebody had to say something, you know? Yeah. So there it is.
Yeah.
The pardon process, if I may.
Yeah, of
the
course.
The pardon
yeah.
process is supposed to be very simple and very direct. You go to www.justice.gov/pardon and you fill out apply for clemency. And it's supposed to be that easy. But what they do is they take your application and they send it to the FBI to do a background investigation on you. And they want to know, are you sorry for what you did? Have you said so in public? Have you committed another crime? Are you an asshole to people? You know, all kinds of different things. And then they send that whole package to your prosecutors. And they say to the prosecutors, John here wants a pardon. What do you guys think about that? Well, this is what they think. This is what they think about just about everybody. Then they send it to your sentencing judge. And they ask the judge, who's 99% of the time a former prosecutor. And they say, you want to give this guy a pardon? And the judge usually says, no, no pardon for him. And then it goes to the deputy attorney general. The deputy attorney general says, no, no pardon for him. Then it goes to the White House chief of staff. And the White House chief of staff makes a recommendation to the president. That is, unless you have money or influence. These pardons that Donald Trump has been giving, nobody applied for those pardons. He just gave them. You remember this this Green Beret war criminal that was pardoned at the very, very end of Trump's first term? He didn't apply for a pardon. Fox News talked about his case every single night for a month and a half, and then he got a pardon. Another one was this crooked judge, the Kids for Cash judge.
Right.
He hadn't applied for a pardon. And even the governor of Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, said, whoa, wait a minute. Where'd this pardon yeah. come from?
This literally a guy who ruins the lives of children for money, a judge.
He right? literally sold children yeah. into bondage. Yes.
So disgusting.
So if you've got, you know,
but you don't get a pardon.
Nah. And then I didn't get a pardon. So if you've got.
Or commutation, I think, is what he got, right? That guy? Did he get a pardon or a commutation? Okay, I think a commutation.
Did he get a commutation?
Maybe, I don't know, whatever. But maybe,
yeah, but if you've got money or you have daily access to Fox News and you can get in the president's face every night, or you have, you know, a very important and very well-placed friend who can just walk into the Oval Office and say, hey, do me a solid and pardon this guy. Otherwise, you know, your chances are nil. And I point out in this piece that I wrote, Actually, now that I mention it, I didn't even realize that it had run. Did it run today? You saw it today?
I think yesterday.
Here, okay. Now I'll look for it. Email, So I point out that that the number of pardons that have been given by the last, you know, four or five presidents are dwarfed by the number of pardons that used to be given. I mean, even Richard Nixon pardoned 22% of the people who applied. Well, now we're down to more like 2%. 2%. Yeah, what happened to forgiveness? You know, when I got home from prison, I went to the courthouse in Arlington, Virginia to register to vote. And they said, did you get an approval from the governor? And I said, oh, I didn't realize that I had to get an approval from the governor. They said, only in Virginia and Florida, you have to get the approval of the governor. I'm like, okay. So I go on to the governor's website. It was Terry McAuliffe at the time. And I said, you know, I'm a convicted felon. I was convicted of violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1981. And I would like the right to vote. I paid my debt to society, right? Like 2 weeks later, my doorbell rings at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it's a courier, and he's got this big envelope, like this big, but it's like a hard, stiff cardboard envelope. And I pull it out, and it's this gubernatorial declaration with a big seal, the big gold seal on it. And it's signed by the governor, and it's a pardon. It's a gubernatorial pardon, which was a really sweet thing to do. I hadn't been convicted of committing a state crime, but what it did was it was symbolic, and it allowed me to register to vote. So I went to register to vote again when I got the big certificate, and there's a box. Have you ever been convicted of a felony? And I said, yes. Have you been pardoned by the governor? So I checked, yes. And they said that the guy who handles your kind of cases, and the woman winks at me, he's on vacation today. And I said, oh, but today's the last day to register so that I can vote in the election. She said, don't worry about it. You can vote in the election. On the following Monday, this guy from the courthouse comes to my house and gives me my voter registration card. And he said, we know what you did. I wanted to make this as easy as possible. Nice. So people have been awesome. It's these presidents who have been dicks. And Mitch McConnell, I'd like to smack in his turtle face too, but that's just me.
That would be his final moments, I think. He's like,
I think so. He's pretty He's pretty well dead as it is. You know, when I was working on the Hill, we used to make fun of him because he lives in this townhouse that's literally four doors down from the Hart Senate office building. So he lives like literally 150 feet from his office. And he used to take a limo every morning, the 150 feet. And we would boo him as he drove by. Like, what a loser.
Well, John, you're such a, I ran into you at the Peace Ball, and I told my friend who I was with, I was like, he is the best storyteller ever. Yeah. You really are. You should have like a daily pod. I mean, you should just tell stories all the time. But what are your thoughts on Elon Musk and also on USAID? Because one of the reasons that I think you're such a great guest is because you're, and someone to talk to, is you don't have like a particular political kind of like formula, right? So you're critical of Elon Musk. You're also critical of USAID. Tell us about the connection between USAID and the CIA. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary, and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
Easter should be the best day of the year. It's a celebration of the resurrection of hope. Come to Crossroads Church and celebrate an empty tomb and a living hope. Info and service times at crossroads.net.